We're starting with a pretty general chapter, and another thing I want to suggest is that you take old school notes, by which I mean, you have these slideshows already on the Hoffman site. You could print them out if you wanted to, and I've had people do that before, and people take notes in the margins of the pictures. If that truly works for you, fine. Do what works for you. But I think it's much better simply to do what most of you appear to be doing, which is starting with a blank sheet of paper and writing down important things that I say. To make that easier, though, because this set of notes you're about to make should not be considered your final version of your notes. Your notes are there to study for my exams. You'll be able to put some stuff down, but you're not going to be able to get down everything I say. And that's okay. I want you to refine your notes, though, by listening to the recordings later. All right? And then study the hell out of those notes and the lectures by repeated audition until, like I said, you're able to explain things by yourself. Well, to make that easier, you should keep track of the slide number. So the slide number is in red on the bottom right of every one, and I try to make an effort to, announce which slide we're on when I change, but you should actually draw a line and write down the slide number in your notes so that when you go back and refine them, it'll be a lot easier. You can go to the appropriate place in the recording, on the synchronized slideshow, which is the same slides as we're looking at here. Anyway, you'll also notice, eventually, that almost none of my slides features very much text. They're almost all just pictures. And that is not just laziness on my part. I do that intentionally because what I've noticed is that even though you have, as I said, already access to all of these, which means if you had a bunch of text in these slides, you would already have that. People will write down text in their notes simply because it's text. Why would you do that if you already have that document available to you online? You're just wasting your time by copying down text, especially because it keeps you from listening to me. So I just avoid that whole thing by not giving you text to begin with. You have to write down what you're hearing. It's more important to listen to me, though. And, like I said, to ask questions when needed. But the first slide of this opening chapter has to do with life, which obviously is appropriate for biology, which is the study of life. Life, though, is not a truly easy thing to define. Now, we all have a feeling for what it means to be alive, but it's when you actually try to make a dictionary definition of it, it's harder than you might think. By the way, there are three kinds of things in the universe, speaking of life, one of which is living things. What are the other two categories of objects?
Inanimate?
That can be either of any of the three. There are living things that are inanimate. For instance, a cyst of a bacterium can be sitting there not seeming alive at all for decades. So, let me just say it's not one of my three categories. But if an object is not living, what is it? Non-living is one of the other categories. And what about the third? What is something that's neither living nor non-living? Any idea? I'm sure you've heard of these things. Dead things. What is the difference between dead and non-living? Well, a dead thing once lived, right? Just is no longer living. A non-living thing, like a rock, for instance, never did live. That's the difference. But I bring that up also because the difference between dead and living is kind of gets to this definition of life. Life is a process. It's a chemical process. Life is really, when you get down to it, metabolism. Metabolism, which we'll have much more to say about as we go through the term, is the sum of all the chemical reactions that are occurring in an organism. And that's really what life is. It is all the chemistry that's happening within an organism. That's not happening after death. The body of the organism might still be there, or will for a while, but it's no longer undergoing those chemical reactions. Still, though, a definition of a living thing or an organism is a little bit tricky. And so what we usually do is not try to just give you an easy, concise dictionary definition. Instead, we list these seven major things, these seven major characteristics that all living things have or exhibit. Some of these things, by the way, are exhibited by non-living things or by dead things, but not all of them. So I've said living thing today, and I've said organism, which are kind of interchangeable terms. But an organism has a specific structural requirement. We're in the middle of a pandemic right now, so we've been talking about viruses just as humans for a while now, for years. Is a virus an organism? Yes. Everyone agree with that? If so, then everyone is wrong. A virus is not an organism. A virus is not alive. People on the news all the time say that doing some sort of sanitation technique will kill the virus. It's not alive to begin with. All you do is damage the molecules it's made out of so that it can no longer have an effect on living things. But it is not itself alive. It has no metabolism. And structurally speaking, it doesn't have the bare minimum requirement for being an organism, which is to have at least one cell. It's much less complex than just one cell. All right? Well, it also doesn't have most of these seven major characteristics of living things. Let's go through these one at a time, though, clockwise, starting with response to the environment. Living things respond to the environment. They don't live in isolation, in other words. I mean, you know this already just from living. Things happen outside of your body that causes your body to react in certain ways. That's not true for just us animals. Any living thing, a bacterium, a plant, a fungus, whatever. Reproduction. Now, not all living things reproduce. For instance, I have chosen not to. That doesn't make me not living. But right, reproduction here refers to the capacity for reproduction, even though it might not actually happen. And by the way, this is one of those characteristics of living things that some non-living things have as well. Some crystals, for instance, reproduce. Like I said, some things have some non-living things have some of these characteristics. They just won't have all of them. Growth and development, which is actually two things but lumped into one. Growth, of course, refers to an increase in size. Now, that actually applies to all organisms in terms of size, or in terms of the cells that I was talking about that every organism requires one of in order, by definition, to be an organism. Well, there's two types of organisms with respect to cell number. There are unicellular organisms, each of which is just one cell big. And there are multicellular organisms like we are. But even for a unicellular organism, that organism undergoes growth. And that's because part of what's called cell theory, which says that all cells come from pre-existing cells. In other words, cells, at least no longer, don't just pop into existence. To get a cell, you have to have another cell that makes that cell before that. Now, obviously, this hasn't always been true. There has to be the original cells. And we'll talk more about that in a different chapter. That happened a long time ago when conditions were really different on Earth. Since then, though, in the 4 billion years since then, cells come into existence only by pre-existing cells making new cells. And they usually do this by splitting into two. Well, it should stand to reason, just logically, common sense-wise, that if one cell splits into two cells, neither of those two cells is going to be as big as the original cell, right? So even unicellular organisms grow up to a point. We grow, though, by adding a hell of a lot more cells to our body. We start out as one cell, the zygote that we started out with as, and now we are how many cells big? You have a feel for that? An average adult human. Just roughly. 200 billion is an enormous number, but it's not much of a human, really. It's about 100 trillion cells. So 200 billion would be what? What, just 1/500th of you? Not very much, actually. I mean, there are 100 billion cells just in your bloodstream. Anyway, that's multicellular organisms come in all sizes. There's plenty of things way bigger than we are, but we are pretty gigantic compared to most things that are alive. Development, by the way, is a little bit different because development refers to changes along the way. So we start out as one zygote, a cell. We are now roughly 100 trillion cells, but there are all kinds of different cells. We're not just 100 trillion copies of the zygote. There are neurons, there are muscle cells, and so on, because things go down different developmental pathways. Energy processing will be something we focus on in the third unit, which will be probably the most difficult part for most people. That's important because organisms cannot continue to be alive. They can't undergo metabolism continuously unless there is continuous processing of energy. We need to exchange materials and energy with the environment continuously. We'll talk a lot more about that. Regulation is a hallmark of living things as well. Regulation refers to keeping things within certain set limits. And a big part of regulation is what we call homeostasis. Stasis means staying. Homeo means same. It's kind of a misnomer because no organism actually stays the same without changing. Homeostasis simply means the change is not very much. If it goes, something gets too high or too low outside of the limits, death will occur. So homeostasis is maintenance of a relatively stable internal environment in an organism. And we'll talk about ways in which that's achieved. Then you have order. This is another one that a lot of non-living things have. You know, like crystals, again, are very highly ordered structures. But even kind of chaotic-looking organisms, like a sponge or a coral, you know, they might not even have symmetry, but still there is a really high degree of order somewhere in them. This flower is just one example. And that, by the way, that high degree of order doesn't come free. Being so highly ordered actually is energetically expensive, so it comes back to energy processing again. And then that leaves the last one, evolutionary adaptation, which we should pay attention to both of those two terms in that phrase. Adaptation, what does it mean to adapt? Now, I don't mean in biological terms, just in everyday use of the word.
Getting used to it?
Yeah, but it's more than getting used to it. It's, go ahead.
It's being able to adapt, like, to consume and change.
Change in such a way that it's an adjustment. And that's what I think you meant by getting used to. You make an adjustment so that you are fit to the environment, right? I mean, that's why we call the power supplies for your electronic devices adapters. It's made to adapt an AC power source to a DC power requirement for the computer or other device. Right, it's an adjustment for existing well in the set of conditions. Well, that applies to biological organisms as well. So adaptation, we use that same word fitness in biology to refer to how well adapted a species is to the set of conditions in which that species lives. What about evolution, though? What does that word by itself mean? What does it mean to evolve?
Be able to adjust and improve your situation?
Well, it doesn't necessarily mean that, no. All evolution means by itself is change. All right? And if you go on to 182, which deals with evolution a lot more than this term, course does, you'll learn that there's three major mechanisms of evolution, but they're not necessarily adaptive. Only one of those mechanisms of evolution is adaptive, meaning it's change in such a way that the species over generations, not within the lifetime, individuals don't evolve, but species evolve over several generations. Between generations is when the change occurs. If evolution occurs in such a way that the fitness of that species, how well adapted it is, increases, then it's not only evolution, it's evolutionary adaptation. And does anyone know what kind of evolution, what mechanism leads to evolutionary adaptation? Who is famous for evolution?
Darwin.
Darwin. And if you randomly poll people from the street, most of them would say Darwin's famous for evolution. He's not actually famous for evolution. He's famous for being the first to come up with a hypothesis for how evolution can lead to adaptation. And so what he's actually famous for specifically is this mechanism I'm talking about, which is natural selection. Natural selection is just one type of evolution. But natural selection is evolution that actually increases the adaptation of that species over generations. All right. And we'll talk more about that in this course, but you'll get a much fuller treatment of that in 182 if you take it. Let's go on to slide 2. What we have represented by these pictures in this slide is a hierarchy, a nested arrangement of things, in other words, kind of like the arrangement of an outline. People still taught outlines in school? I haven't thought about this in a while. Were you taught outlines? Okay, well, that's a hierarchy also. This is the hierarchy of biological organization, meaning how organisms are organized by humans. This is a human construct. We like to keep things in nice, neat little boxes. But the reason it's a hierarchy is that each of these levels is contained in a higher level, which is then contained in a higher level, and so on, until you get to the top. So I'm going to start at the smallest levels on the bottom right here, and then go to bigger groups. Now, there are things that are smaller than atoms and molecules, as we'll talk about in this course. So don't think that there's nothing below atoms. But when you get below the level of atoms, you're really not so much in biology anymore as you are in chemistry or physics. I should mention, by the way, that especially early on, you're probably going to think you're in a chemistry course more so than a biology course. But that actually makes sense, because speaking of this sequence, Bio 181 and 182, the difference in those, they're both really important courses because they're basic courses. Basic does not mean easy. Basic means fundamental. It's all the important bases or fundamentals of biology. So if you're a biology major, these are the two most important courses. You're going to learn this stuff over and over in other courses, but this is your first major exposure to it. And that's why you should make the most of this course, not just for the grade. But anyway, the big difference between the two is that in Bio 181, we're staying within the cell. This is cell biology, really. In 182, it's everything bigger than a cell. Well, what happens in a cell? Chemistry. The metabolism I was talking about, which is life itself, really, when you get down to it. Anyway, let's start with atoms. Atoms is a level by itself in the hierarchy. We'll talk much more about atoms in a little bit, but atoms of different types get together to form more complex structures called molecules. So that's a new level. And this brings up, by the way, the notion of what's called emergent properties. To emerge means to come out, right? Emergent properties are properties that one bigger level has that smaller levels within it do not have. For instance, there are things that are true of molecules that aren't true of the atoms that make up those molecules. And so on for the other levels. Those are emergent properties. A molecule is not alive. An atom is not alive. Eventually, you'll get to a level where you actually have something that's alive. That's another emergent property. Okay? But right now, we're focusing on the nesting or the hierarchy of this arrangement. atoms make up molecules. That's the next level. Molecules of different types combine into more complex structures that are called organelles. An organelle is an example of a subcellular structure. So are atoms and molecules, for that matter. Subcellular simply means smaller than a cell. They are parts of a cell. But organelles, the word, literally means little organ, because they are like organs in our body, only within an invisibly small cell. And some of these organelles you might have heard about, like mitochondria or Golgi complex, things like that. We'll go through those one at a time in a different chapter, but those are organelles. Another level. Organelles of different kinds collect into a bigger structure called a cell. And now we suddenly have an organism. Or part of an organism if it's a multicellular organism. But until you get to that one cell, you're not talking about a living thing. That's why I was saying earlier that a virus is not an organism. A virus is just a couple molecules that interact with living things. That's why we're in this pandemic, but they're not themselves alive. Okay, now another thing I want to mention here is that if you're talking about a unicellular organism, which you should not discount, because most organisms that are alive right now are unicellular, and by far most organisms that have ever existed have been unicellular. They vastly, vastly outnumber the multicellular organisms. It's just that we pay attention to the multicellular organisms because they're conspicuous. They're visible macroscopically. We're one of them. We put importance in them. But bacteria rule the world, really, and they're just one type of unicellular organism. Anyway, if you're talking about a unicellular organism, then this cell level, and one we haven't gotten to yet after we skipped some, the organism level would be the same level for them. Right? Because the one cell that they have is the organism. And they wouldn't have these ones in between. But these ones in between cell and organism are true for multicellular organisms like us. So cells of different types get together to form more complex structures called tissues. For instance, in us animals, there are four kinds of tissues: muscular tissue, nervous tissue, connective tissue, and epithelial tissue. Plants have different kinds of tissues as well compared to animals, but they're collections of cells of different types performing a specific function. So that's its own level. Tissues of different types then collect into even more complex structures called organs. And organs and organ systems here, even though they're together, are two different levels. Organs is the next level above tissues. So familiar things in your body, like the skin is an organ, the kidneys are organs, and so on. Organ systems are collections of different organs, but performing a common function, like the digestive system, the circulatory system, and so on in us. All right, so that's another level. And then all of the various organ systems combined make up the one individual organism, which is the next level. Like I said earlier, though, you wouldn't find those in a unicellular organism. Organism and cell is the same level for a unicellular organism. All right, now we're well into Bio 182 material here because we're up way bigger than a cell already. But organisms don't live in isolation, right? Organisms of the same species living together, wherever it is, make up a population. Next level. Now, a population is just the members of a single species. There's different ways to define species, but that's a 182 issue also. For instance, all of the elm trees of a certain species would make up that population of elm trees. But that's not the only thing you find in that place they live, right? So that brings up the difference between population and community. A community is the same place as the population, but the community includes all of the species, not just one, that live there. Now, what then is the difference between community and ecosystem? Well, you might be thinking, and a lot of students have done this, and it's reasonable to make this assumption, but it's just wrong. You might be thinking, well, a community is a group of populations, so an ecosystem might be a group of communities. That's not how it's defined, though. All three are the same place. Population is just one species there. Community is the same place, but all the species. Only the species, though. Only the organisms. The ecosystem is the same place, but it includes the community, which is all of the organisms there, plus all of the non-living things that are there as well. So the ecosystem includes the rocks and the water and the air, whereas the community does not. And only one more level, which is the biosphere, which is all of the ecosystems on this one planet, which for now is the only place that we know there is life. Now, just for mathematical reasons alone, it is almost certain that there's a lot of life out there in the universe. Simply because there's a hell of a lot of universe out there. But it's also pretty probable that we'll never come into contact with any of it because of the enormous distances involved. This is science, though, so we can't just say it's probable, so we're going to say it's true. You have to demonstrate things to be true. So until we know with good evidence that there is life elsewhere, even though we can assume there is, we can't state categorically that there is. And therefore, the biosphere is still spherical. It's the biosphere because the Earth is a sphere. The biosphere is not the entire Earth, though. The biosphere is a hollow sphere with a thickness to its wall. The thickness of the wall of the biosphere is actually getting thicker and thicker because we keep discovering things in places where we thought there could not be possibly anything living here, like deep in the ocean or in rocks and things like that. But we keep being surprised by that, and so every time we discover new life, the biosphere gets a little bit thicker and it's in the wall. But the thickness is how far deep you can go and still find living things, and how far into the atmosphere you can go and still find living things. Still a sphere, though. Well, once we discover, if we do, life somewhere else, it will no longer be spherical shaped, and it'll be a hell of a lot bigger all of a sudden, but it'll still be called the biosphere. All right, slide 3. These don't all go this slowly, by the way. We'll make it through all these slideshows. Some of the slides go fast. The photograph in the background of this one represents an ecosystem, as I've already defined it. It doesn't matter which specific example you're using as an ecosystem. The point is it's an ecosystem. And for any given ecosystem, almost any ecosystem, the ones at the surface of the Earth, which is the vast majority of ecosystems, there's a difference in the way energy and matter interact with an ecosystem. Now, energy we'll talk much more about later, but energy is not material. Matter is material. It's the same word, really. The difference here is that I was talking about is that for any given ecosystem, energy flows through that ecosystem. It enters, it leaves. Now, it doesn't leave as the same kind of energy it came in as. In the vast majority of ecosystems like the ones we live in, the energy comes in as sunlight. But it gets transformed and transferred within the ecosystem. Energy does. Transform means being changed from one form of energy to another, like from sunlight, which is radiant energy, or electromagnetic energy, to chemical energy, for instance. There can be many transformations. Transferring means it gets moved from one object to another. So it bounces around, gets moved. But eventually it exits the ecosystem, usually as heat, which is not shown here by a red arrow, but I think the next slide shows one. That's what I mean by a flow through, though. On the other hand, matter, the stuff of the universe, atoms, is cycled within the ecosystem. Now, of course, there is some leakage. It's not 100% perfect. But for the most part, the stuff that's in an ecosystem stays there. It doesn't stay the same. It gets changed continuously because the atoms will be part of living things at one moment, non-living things the next. Your body is not the same body you had yesterday. It's made out of your surroundings, and it's continuously being rebuilt throughout your lifetime. I mean, you are what you eat is literally true. You build your body out of the stuff that you eat, which is other organisms, but also non-living things. The stuff you breathe also becomes part of you. And so that's what the green arrows represent, a recycling of matter, whereas there is a flow through of energy. Well, slide 4 shows you the heat arrows I was talking about. Sunlight's coming in, it gets transformed and transferred into different kinds of energy, and then leaves as heat. But the stuff in the ecosystem, the material, stays put for the most part. Now, what is the real time? I forgot my chronograph. Oh, really? I'm already over? Oh, that's right. That's slow. All right. Sorry.